malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right. Let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace.
The Civil War was over, and with it, the life of Abraham Lincoln, 16th President of the United States. Andrew Johnson was his successor. To Congress, a man bent on carrying into peacetime the extraordinary powers granted Lincoln in wartime. Congress determined to reassert its power over the president and gathered strength for battle. Thaddeus Stevens of Pennsylvania addressed the House of Representatives.
I tell you, Congress is the sovereign power, because the people speak through them. Andrew Johnson must learn that he is your servant, and that, as Congress shall order, he must obey. There is no escape from it. God forbid that the president should have one whit of power except what he derives through Congress and the Constitution. Gentlemen, the president has criminally violated the Constitution and the laws. And I, for one, propose to put him on trial.
A majority of the members of the House of Representatives favored the impeachment of President Johnson, and so it was voted. The articles of impeachment were drafted and approved. Then, under the Constitution, the president was required to stand trial before the United States Senate, where, if judged guilty by 2/3 of its members present and voting, he would be removed from office.
Article 10 of the impeachment of the president. Andrew Johnson, unmindful of the high duties of his office, designing to set aside the rightful authorities and powers of Congress, did attempt to bring into disgrace, ridicule, and reproach the Congress of the United States. Mr. Senator Anthony, how say you, is the president guilty or not guilty of a high misdemeanor as charged in this article?
I say he is guilty.
Mr. Senator Baird, how say you, is the president guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty.
Mr. Senator Buckaloo.
Not guilty.
Mr. Senator Cameron.
Guilty.
Mr. Senator Cattell.
Guilty.
Mr. Senator Chandler.
Guilty.
It was clear, as the roll call of the Senate began, that the vote would be very close. So close, in fact, that the outcome could not be predicted. A majority of members did favor conviction, but a substantial minority did not. If this minority numbered more than a third of the senators, the president would be judged not guilty.
Mr. Senator Ferry.
Guilty.
Mr. Senator Fessenden.
Not guilty.
Mr. Senator Fowler.
Not guilty.
Mr. Senator Frelinghuysen.
Guilty.
Mr. Senator Grimes.
Not guilty.
As the roll call continued and votes were tallied, it became clear that if the junior senator from Kansas, Edmund Ross, spoke the word guilty, the president would be convicted. No one in the Senate chamber knew how the senator would vote.
Mr. Senator Ross, how say you? Is the president guilty or not guilty as charged?
As I look back on that moment, I remember that every individual in that great audience seemed distinctly visible. Not a whisper was heard. The senators in their seats leaned over their desks, many with hand to ear. I almost literally looked down into my open grave. Friendships, position, fortune, everything that makes life desirable to an ambitious man were about to be swept away by the breath of my mouth.
Mr. Senator Ross, how say you? Is the president guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty.
Louder. Senator.
I say he is not guilty.
It seemed to me later that in a large sense, the independence of the executive office as a branch of the government was on trial. If the president must step down a disgraced man from partisan considerations, the office of president would ever after be subordinated to the legislative will. It would practically have revolutionized our splendid political fabric into a congressional autocracy.
So, in the end, it was the members of the Congress of the United States who themselves limited the power of Congress. President Johnson remained in office. But the legislative branch had forcefully asserted itself, and the years following the Civil War were, basically, years of congressional government. Political power rested, for the most part, in the hands of the senators and congressmen of the time. It was these men of the Congress who shaped the destiny of the nation as it entered the age of steam, of iron and steel, of industrial might. Senator Henry Wilson of Massachusetts.
Gentlemen, we are asked to give the railroad money and land. I, for one, would cheerfully sink $100 million to build the road and think I had done a great thing for my country. What are $75 million or $100 million in opening a railroad across regions of this continent that shall connect the people of the Atlantic and the Pacific and bind us together? Nothing. As to the lands, I don't begrudge them.
Letter to the Honorable John Sherman, Senator from the state of Ohio. As president of the Texas and Pacific Railroad Company, I should be honored to have you join our party, which plans to travel from Philadelphia to the Pacific coast, leaving about the 12th of August, 1872. We desire to acquaint members of Congress with the...
I accepted the invitation and made a memorable voyage to the Pacific coast. Great changes since my boyhood. The Indians and the buffaloes had disappeared from the plains. In California, a whole new civilization. The most restless and adventurous of our population. Some of the worst and many of the best. Los Angeles, a typical Mexican town. We journeyed back east to Salt Lake City, not long carved from a wilderness, and passed on to the mines of Denver. Then Kansas, Missouri, and Indiana. Surely the most fertile valley of the world. And I thought, all of this has been redeemed from nature and the Indians less than 100 years ago. And all of it we are passing over in a palace car. It was a new America I was seeing, a land of vast mountains and prairies, of growing cities and industry. I sensed that this growth was but the beginning.
The Great Pacific Railway for California hail. Bring on the locomotive, lay down the iron rail. Across the rolling prairies, by steam we're bound to go. The railroad cars are coming, humming through New Mexico. The railroad cars are coming, humming through New Mexico.
In the second half of the 19th century, Americans began moving off the farms and into the cities, drawn by new industries, textiles, coal, iron, and steel. America was industrializing, becoming prosperous. James G. Blaine, Speaker of the House in the 1870s.
Economists consider that the material advance of a people is measured more accurately by the consumption of iron than by any other article. Assuming this to be the test, the progress of the American people is beyond precedent. Since the civil struggle, iron production has attained levels many-fold greater than those for the entire preceding century. Such progress is not only unprecedented, it is phenomenal. It could not have been except under wise laws which stimulate enterprise and quicken capital. To Congress as a whole, in its accumulated wisdom, credit and honor are due.
And as America grew rich and mighty, its people prospered, at least some of its people.
Newport is very gay this year. They're trying to put in electric lights at the Cornelius Vanderbilt House. Mr. Vanderbilt is truly one of the most delightful of men. Sleeves are as big as skirts, and skirts are 9 yards round. Oh, if I had to make one New Year's resolution, I'd resolve to go on doing exactly what I am doing, only more of it, until I'm 60.
But life could not go on quite the same. The Industrial Revolution that produced a rich nation had also produced a host of discontented. Soon the laboring man began to raise his voice.
You will eat by and by. In the glorious land in the sky, way up high, work and pray. Live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die.
In the last two decades of the century, there were perhaps 30,000 strikes. Beginning in 1893, severe depression gripped the country. Farmers, too, found their prosperity threatened or destroyed outright. In Kansas, a straight-talking housewife named Mary Elizabeth Lease sounded the call of thousands of discontented farmers.
I tell you, what you farmers need to do is raise less corn and more hail.
Yes.
Now, I'm just a Middle West housewife, but I can see with my own eyes. While 30 men in the United States have over $1.5 billion, there are 500,000 men looking for work. Meanwhile, 10,000 children starve to death every year. I say, money rules. We no longer have a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. We have a government of Wall Street, by Wall Street, and for Wall Street. I tell you, the people in this country, on farms and factories alike, the people demand reform.
The voices raised throughout the nation were clearly reflected in a debate over public policy even then taking place in the United States Congress. Robert La Follette was a young congressman from Wisconsin.
Two opposite ideas of government had begun a grapple for mastery in this country. Shall government be for the benefit of the private interests, or shall government be for the benefit of the public interest? This was the simple issue. When I entered the House in 1885, the consideration of private interest of all sorts had all but overwhelmed Congress. I do not mean to imply that there was no constructive movement then going forward, or that patriotic men in both houses of Congress were not doing their best to reassert the power of popular government and to grapple with the mighty private industries.
Within a very few years, a majority of the members of Congress supported legislation which was meant to reform our economy for the benefit of the nation as a whole. For instance, in 1887...
An Interstate Commerce Commission is hereby created to regulate commerce between the states and to ensure fair and equitable rates on the nation's railroads.
And in 1890...
As a member of Congress, I support the Sherman Antitrust Act.
Members of Congress saw that the older policies were no longer tenable. And in those years, the government began to consider seriously the condition of the common man, the worker, the farmer.
The concern for the common man underlies a history of constructive social and economic legislation passed by the United States Congress beginning in the 1890s and continuing into the present day.
1906.
The Pure Food and Drug Act is hereby passed. Henceforth, no harmful drugs, chemicals, and preservatives shall be used in foods and drugs.
1910.
In supporting the bill to buy back forest lands from private investors, I cast my vote for a more beautiful America.
1913.
3/4 of the state legislatures have today completed ratification of a 17th Amendment to the Constitution proposed by the Congress of the United States. All members of the Senate shall henceforth be elected by popular vote, and they shall be directly responsible to the citizens of each state. The office is no longer subject to appointment by the various state legislatures.
1916.
They voted an 8-hour day for all railroad workers.
1919.
From this date on, no woman shall be denied the right to vote. Congress has passed on it, and the states approve.
And then, just as the promise of America seemed almost fulfilled, the American economy collapsed.
Values have shrunk to fantastic levels. Taxes have risen. Our ability to pay has fallen. The withered leaves of industrial enterprise lie on every side. Farmers find no markets for their produce. and the savings of many years in thousands of families are gone.
In the crisis of depression, Congress once again turned to the pressing needs of all Americans as senators and representatives listened to President Franklin Delano Roosevelt take office in March 1933.
This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. This nation is asking for action, and action now.
And the members of Congress responded.
We in Congress must pass the Civilian Conservation Corps.
The bill before us would create a federal emergency relief administration. We must help the unemployed find food, clothing, and shelter.
A Securities and Exchange Commission to protect the investing public.
A Farm Credit Administration has been proposed. I say we in Congress must help the farmers.
Congress hereby creates a National Labor Relations Board.
A Works Progress Administration to provide jobs.
The Tennessee Valley Authority to provide electricity for and to help rehabilitate the entire Tennessee Valley.
A minimum wage for all workers to ensure a decent standard of living.
A government plan to see that no American over 65 is left helpless without income. Social Security.
Congress acted and the nation weathered its great domestic economic crisis. The country was on the road to becoming stronger than ever. But an even greater crisis lay ahead. In addition to economic and social legislation, the constant preoccupation of Congress in the 20th century has been the determination of America's place in world affairs. In 1917, the United States entered World War I. Sent troops abroad to fight in foreign countries. But when the war was won, the troops came home, and further international involvement seemed to a great many Americans to be both unnecessary and unwise. We wanted to reject entangling alliances, sought instead the security of normalcy and isolation. The Senate of the United States, reflecting these attitudes, rejected President Woodrow Wilson's Treaty of Versailles with its internationalist League of Nations. And for nearly two decades, America stood apart. But by the late 1930s, war had returned to half the globe, and Americans wondered if they must once again take part, engaging now in a bitter struggle between so-called interventionists and isolationists. Nowhere was this fight more pronounced than in the halls of Congress. Friendly governments in Europe and in the Far East struggled to remain free. Many were crushed, and then...
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked. By naval and air
Senator Vandenberg of Michigan, a leader of congressional opposition to foreign involvement, spoke for the Congress.
I have fought every trend which I thought would lead to needless war. But when war comes to us, I stand with my commander-in-chief for the swiftest and most invincible reply of which our total strength may be capable.
America was in the war. The great 20th century debate was settled. Congress had voted for the end of isolation. When the war was over and won, Congress underlined its belief in America's role in world affairs by voting for the Marshall Plan, the North Atlantic Treaty, for aid to underdeveloped nations. And with congressional approval, the United States had taken the lead in creating the new United Nations. Today, Congress, working with the President, continues to determine and to clarify the position of the United States as a world power, just as here at home, its basic concern for the prosperity and well-being of all the American people is pursued with renewed vigor. The small group of men who first met in New York in 1789 represented this country in its infancy just as surely as the men and women who now sit in the Congress in Washington represent our nation in its maturity. The times have changed, of course, and the issues have changed. But no matter what the times or the issues, the vital concerns of the day will ever be raised and debated in the Congress by the elected representatives of all the people. Joseph Cannon of Illinois, Speaker of the House in the early years of the 20th century, rose before the membership on the occasion of his 80th birthday, and after 40 years of legislative service, he recalled the great men of the Congress, of the Senate, and of the House alike.
If I sometimes see the faces and hear the voices of others not now here to answer the roll call, I may not be charged with dreaming, for they typify the spirit of a representative democracy as truly as do the words and works of those who laid the foundations of this government in the beginning.
Representative James Madison of Virginia. Representative John Quincy Adams of Massachusetts. Representative Henry Clay of Kentucky. Senator Daniel Webster of Massachusetts. Senator John C. Calhoun of South Carolina. Representative Abraham Lincoln of Illinois.
The roll of honor continues. We will hear the voices of Congress, our voices, for as long as the American people uphold their tradition of democracy and of freedom.
Robert M. La Follette of Wisconsin. Senator Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts. Representative Sam Rayburn of Texas. Senator Arthur Vandenberg of Michigan. Representative Fiorello LaGuardia of New York. Senator Charles McNary of Oregon. Senator Robert A. Taft of Ohio. Senator Harry S. Truman of Missouri. Senator John F. Kennedy of Massachusetts. Senator Lyndon B. Johnson of Texas.